Welcome to episode 496 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a wonderful conversation with acclaimed filmmaker, writer, director, actor, activist, Elamaya Tailfeathers. We talk with Elamaya from her home at the Blood Reserve in southern Alberta, Canada. We delve into a bit about her familial and cultural background, influences, ancestors, her films, in particular, The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open. We discuss the meaning of empathy, being cliche, privilege, her new Amazon-produced series titled Three Pines, and The Journey Home, among other things. A grand conversation with Elamaya Tailfeathers this go-round. We have an EW essay titled Sagebrush. We share a piece from the September 2022 issue of The Sun magazine, written by Elizabeth Bradfield, titled Plastic, A Personal History. And we have an EW poem called 500 Years. All of this, of course, will be infused, imbued with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to be with you. Let's get to it. Episode 496 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
All your clothes, just left them in the street. You ran towards the water. You were looking back at me. There's a hole inside the heavens now. A staircase to the stars. So I took off my coat and followed you into the dark. And are you coming with me now?
sagebrush. I saw a shooting star last night. It was a quick, slanted flare downward from the right. It was silver-white, bright. The other stars shone light from years past as a backdrop, endless, carrying infinity through us and continuing forever and ever. I walked back inside into the garage, then into the house. I went looking for a particular monthly magazine, hoping to find a short story, perhaps an essay, a poem or two, to travel within, another sort of infinity. This world, this life, this place holds so much, yet we are simple as sagebrush blowing across the expanse, rooted in fantasy, fear, and desire. We are not aliens, or illegal, or indigenous, any more or any less than we are willing to accept such categories and classifications. We are all too often cold, callous, clueless, cowardly, and complicit. Yet, self-indulgence obfuscates any sense of awareness. I am enjoying these warm November days. The sunrise through the sparse trees and the warm breeze wafting around colorful red, yellow, orange, brown, black, green leaves me transfixed within the aroma of this great detritus. The planet is warming. Magenta sunrise fills the sky. I am alive. Sister Tailfeathers shares some stories. Will you imbibe?
Yeah.
Elamiah Tailfeathers, is that you?
Hi, yes it is.
It's so nice to have you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. Thank you for taking the time out.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, let me give some of the folks a little bit of background. Elamiah Tailfeathers is a highly acclaimed filmmaker, writer, director, producer, and actor. She is a member of the Kainai First Nation, Blood Tribe Blackfoot Confederacy, as well as the indigenous Same from Norway. Beginning her career as an actor in 2006 and as a filmmaker in 2011, Elamiah is a true creative force both in front of and behind the lens. I first became aware of her work in May of this year when I watched her film The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open. It profoundly affected me. Troubadours and Rock on Tours is very happy to have on the program Elamiah Tailfeathers. Again, thank you.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for that generous introduction.
Oh, it's sincere and true. Let's get started right from the get-go, I guess, or the beginning. Your background, you know, familial, cultural, both, please.
I'm Blackfoot from the Kainai First Nation, or Kaina. It's part of the Blackfoot Confederacy. There's four Blackfoot nations within the Blackfoot Confederacy, and mine is located just north of the Montana border in what's known as Southern Alberta, Canada. And I'm also Sami from Northern Norway. So my father's Sami, and he lives in the village of Unjarga, which is on the northeast coast of Norway, not too far from the Russian border.
Wow. And again, as I mentioned, I did some research. The Sami are indigenous to Norway.
That's right. So Sápmi, which is like our it's what we call our homeland. It's spelled S-A-P-M-I. Sápmi encompasses Norway, Sweden, Finland, and the Kola Peninsula in Russia. Northern Norway, Sweden, Finland, and the Kola Peninsula in Russia. And our people are indigenous to that part of the world.
And then the Kainai First Nation, the Blood Tribe Blackfoot Confederacy, that is a connection to indigenous peoples here in North America.
Yeah. So we're people of the plains, and our territory is very beautiful. We're at the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, and also in the Rocky Mountains. And I live at home, actually, on the Blood Reserve.
And that's where we're speaking with you from now.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Thank you for that background. Now, your family, your history, your culture has definitely influenced you in your work, as far as I can tell. But generally speaking, who has influenced you over the years?
So many people. I think I'm very fortunate to come from two indigenous peoples that have, you know, a long history of storytelling and rich culture and language that's still very much alive. And I'm very lucky to have been raised, immersed in culture and also raised to be proud of who I am and where I come from. And so certainly my communities, my Blackfoot and my Sami communities, have influenced me and inspired me, and my family has inspired me. My grandparents on my mother's side are both survivors of the Indian residential school system here in Canada. I was raised, around a rich sort of storytelling culture. My grandfather was just always telling stories growing up, so it's very much a part of my upbringing. I'm just so fortunate to have been raised around that. And then in Sápmi in Norway, again, there's a really beautiful culture of storytelling that's very much alive and has always been very much a part of our expression as a people. So, you know, growing up, I was exposed to Bjaivash Sami Theater, which is a Sami theater company that does a lot of its plays in the Sami language. And so as a child, I was very fortunate to be able to witness theater, live theater on stage in my own language. We lived in Northern Norway when I was a little girl, and Sami is my first language. And so I was very inspired from a young age by the Sami actors I saw on stage and by the stories that I saw on stage that reflected my own people and our experiences and our voices and our language. So I would say first and foremost, I'm, you know, inspired by my people and my communities and my family. But in terms of my practice as a filmmaker and as an artist, as an actor, there's just so many names, too many to name right now. But I certainly draw a lot of inspiration from the Indigenous film community. It's such a rich and thriving community. There's Indigenous filmmakers from all over the world telling incredible stories on screen, and I draw strength and inspiration from them. So yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah, I feel definitely.
Like I just go on and on and on about everyone that inspires me, and I'm always afraid to start listing names and then forgetting people.
Yeah,
yeah.
I understand that. And when I think about how you were brought up, I'm thinking you were brought up based on what you just shared in Norway then.
Yeah, we lived in Sápmi, in a small town, a small Sami town called Karajohka, which is it's in the Arctic, and we lived there when I was a little girl, and then moved over to Canada and then the United States when I was about 6 years old. My mother decided to go to my mother decided to go into medicine, become a doctor. So that sort of changed the course of my life in terms of my upbringing and where we ended up. So we moved around a lot as I was a kid. I think I went to like 11 different high school or 11 different schools by the time I graduated from high school. So,
wow.
Yeah, a lot of moving around, but, I eventually made my way to Vancouver and started working in film, and I've recently relocated home to the reserve.
That's great. And, when you're in your third decade now, I believe, and you know the earlier years, you moved around a lot. Did you find going from the environment of your relatives, your family in the village that you were brought up in Northern Norway, a difference compared to, you know, in the places you moved to? In the sense of who you were or what you were about, as compared to what you felt you were, given the experience you had as a younger person?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we ended up moving to Grand Forks, North Dakota. My mother went to the University of North Dakota and did a program called Indians into Medicine, or InMed. And so that was quite a culture shock to go from, you know, living in Arctic Norway, you know, speaking the Sami language and immersed in my culture there, to this whole other part of the world. But my parents were always very, very much encouraging of myself and my brother in terms of just remembering who we are and where we come from. And it was certainly challenging. You know, I was often one of the only Indigenous kids in my class, and you know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. My mom was a student, and my father, you know, had some struggles. So yeah, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. So I was often, you know, one of the only Indigenous children in class. And then on top of that, you know, we didn't come from a lot of money. So it was a struggle, but I think it taught me resilience and strength, and also gave me a backbone, and you know, taught me how to adapt. And and I found, you know, various means of expression through the arts, through storytelling and creativity and theater and music and all of those things. So I'm really grateful for the kind of strange upbringing that I had.
Yeah, it sounds like you really benefited from it, for sure. The movies, your two most recent films, the one that I saw, I guess it's the second to most recent that's been released, in May, I mentioned it in the intro, The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open. That, I had COVID, actually, and I was just sitting around on the couch. The symptoms weren't terrible, and I was like, oh, I can't go anywhere. Let me see if I can watch something. And I just was flipping around, and I found your movie, and I watched it. And it, honestly, it's still, I think about it still. And that's why, you know, I said I have to get this person on my show to talk with her. How does that movie give you an opportunity to speak about, to explore some of the issues that are, I guess, connected to your experience? And maybe you can talk about those issues a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the film is, well, thank you for everything you said, and I really appreciate that. And it's so great to know that the film is still resonating with audiences all over the world, years after making it. The film was inspired by an experience that I had, very much like what happened in the film. I lived in the city of Vancouver for quite a while. I lived in New York briefly and lived in Vancouver for quite a while. And much like in the film, like the character of Isla, who I play on screen, I encountered a young Indigenous woman standing in the pouring rain, barefoot, at rush hour, having just run away from her abusive partner. And I ended up taking her home with me. She didn't want to go to the hospital. She didn't want to go to the police, and she had nowhere else to go. So I took this young woman home with me, and it was a life-altering experience. You know, sometimes we have these collisions with strangers that forever alter us, and my experience with her was certainly like that. And it was a major teaching experience for me. It was very humbling in the sense that I thought I knew what to do in a situation like that, but it was a confrontation of my own privilege as somebody who hadn't experienced, you know, physical intimate partner violence like that. And I'd never had to navigate those systems before, and so it was this confrontation of my own privilege, and was also this moment where I was really sort of confronted with my own sort of misgivings about those types of situations. So it was a profoundly life-altering experience, and I carried that story with me for years. I thought about this young woman who I encountered that day probably on a daily basis, because she lived in my neighborhood. It's where I encountered her. It was just a few blocks from home, and I walked past her building probably on a regular, you know, daily basis. And I never saw her again. So I kind of carried that story with me, thinking about her, thinking about the experience, thinking about all of the possibilities in terms of what that experience offered in terms of teaching. And so I decided to just take it and adapt it and fictionalize it. I sought her out. I tried to find her, and I don't even know if she gave me her real name. So I have no idea where she is or how she's doing. But I decided to take that experience and fictionalize it and put it on screen as an opportunity to, you know, honor that experience and give audiences an opportunity to hopefully navigate the difficult terrain of, you know, the collision of class and race and you know, what it means to experience intimate partner violence and the systems that women are forced to navigate in order to get out. So yeah, it's been a pretty incredible experience having made that film. I co-wrote and co-directed with Kathleen Hepburn. She's a very talented filmmaker here in Canada. And it's been a really wonderful experience for us to have been able to put that story on screen and then see the ways that it's sort of traveled around the world and the ways that people all over are connecting with the film, despite it being so specific, you know. There's so many universal aspects to the story that it just sort of keeps traveling on its own, which is quite wonderful.
Oh, yeah. It becomes bigger than the creators after a while, something that good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open is the name of the film, and you're also one of the main actors in it, I should mention. Great job, because everything you wanted to do, at least it worked on me that way. I'm still thinking about it, so thank you. It's beautifully human, and it's also heartbreakingly human, both, in my view. But I could talk about that the whole show. We want to get into some other things. Thank you for that film, though. I guess this is your most recent release. I know you're working on some other projects, but excuse me if I pronounce this wrong. I think it's Guy Ma B. Bitson. Is that right?
Yeah, that's great.
The Meaning of Empathy. I believe this is more of a documentary, and it has to do with the opioid crisis home, I presume.
Yeah, it's a documentary. It's called Guy Ma B. Bitson, The Meaning of Empathy, and Guy Ma B. Bitson is a Blackfoot ideology or teaching that reminds us that through empathy, through compassion for others, through kindness and caring for one another, that's how we survive as a people. And so the film is a quite broad portrait of my community over almost a 4-year period. It documents the response from within our community regarding the opioid crisis or the drug poisoning epidemic. And it was quite the journey. It took over 5 years to make that film. And, you know, it's a portrait of so many different people in the community. We see frontline workers, paramedics, nurses, and addictions counselors. We see my mother, who's a physician here on the reserve. We see people who are in recovery, people who are living with active substance use disorder. And for me, it's a love letter to my community, and it's a portrait of our strength and the love that exists within our community, because so often we're framed from sort of this tragic, traumatic lens where the focus is always on the deficit. But within my community, I see so many people working so hard and facing so many barriers. But finding ways to move forward and finding ways to do so in a way that's rooted in empathy and compassion. And so I wanted to be able to document what I was seeing in my community in a way that allowed for the broader public to be able to witness that love and empathy and compassion and strength that's here. But it also looks at harm reduction through an Indigenous lens. You know, harm reduction, especially here in the province of Alberta, it's a very, very conservative province. Our current governing party is the United Conservative Party of Alberta, and they're very right-leaning and not supportive of harm reduction in any capacity. And so it's been very harmful for not only Indigenous people living with addictions, but for anybody struggling with substance use disorder. And, you know, it's for me, it was an opportunity to document the ways that harm reduction is working in my community and can work, and to explore this very difficult conversation, because it's not only divisive, you know, on a government level, but it's divisive within the broader public and then within my community. You know, a lot of people have misconceptions about what harm reduction is and what it looks like in practice. And so the film is also a portrait of a community practicing harm reduction and learning along the way.
Wonderful, wonderful. We're talking with Ella Maya Tailfeathers, highly acclaimed filmmaker, writer, director, producer, and actor. And it's a pleasure to talk with you.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
Let's get a little broader with our discussion, I guess. And this is a tough question, I suppose, but at the same time, we can go anywhere with it. In your view, Ella Maya, how is our world and its people doing at present?
Oh, man, I struggle with that every day. I think we all do. It's pretty overwhelming, you know, what's happening in the world right now in terms of, well, everything. You know, you listen to the news and there's war and there's climate change, there's everything. And it's quite overwhelming. And so for me as a human, just trying to get through, I've found that I've gained strength from focusing on my community and focusing on the people I know and love and the work that I can do here within my own community in terms of the stories that I tell. And so I think it's like, it's so easy to get caught up in this sort of like negative downward spiral in terms of responding to the world that we're all living in. It can be kind of debilitating and you can feel, I often feel, you know, trapped by climate change anxiety and just overall anxiety in terms of the state of the world. But the way that I'm coping, the way that I'm moving forward, the way that I'm, you know, finding hope and strength is through telling stories about my own community and sort of shining a light, if I can, on the beauty that exists here. And that's kind of how I keep moving forward. And I often think about my ancestors. I think about everything that my people have experienced for the last 500 years. And it's pretty remarkable that I'm here today. It's remarkable that my people are here today, given everything we've been through. And so, you know, when I'm in these moments of spiraling anxiety over the state of the world, I have to kind of reflect on the fact that my ancestors survived so much and overcame so much. And it's remarkable that I'm here, and I need to continue to build on that strength and draw from their strength and recognize that, you know, it's been difficult for a very long time, but we have to just keep moving forward. We have to find ways to resist the harms that are being done in this world. We have to find ways to be creative and to adapt and to change, and we have to do so with love and empathy and compassion for one another. I mean, it sounds a little bit, maybe, I don't know, cliche or silly, but for me, that's how I move through. And I think my documentary, Gimma Bipitsin, The Meaning of Empathy, was really a true lesson in that, in finding strength through love and finding strength through empathy.
Mm. Well said, well said. And, you know, I guess some people might say it sounds cliche or what have you, or pie in the sky, hippy-dippy, all of that, but I don't think that's fair. What's the alternative, right? Being cynical and bitter and closed and apathetic? I guess that, to me, that is the alternative, and isn't that sort of cliche, too, just in the opposite direction?
It is, you're right.
Yeah, but it is, I mean, it's hard for all of us, I'm sure, and we all have our own experiences. Do you feel sometimes or think sometimes that the history of indigenous people puts an extra burden on you know, where they are today and where they might go tomorrow?
You know, I think it's like it's so often that, like, when we discuss these issues of, you know, indigenous lived experience and the realities of indigenous people today, that we're somehow like separate from the rest of the world. We're somehow separate from everybody else. And I think it's so important to recognize that this is a collective history, that settlers in this part of the world are absolutely implicated in this reality. And so often the Indigenous experience is placed in a historical context. It's placed in a way that creates a divide from the now and the past. And I find that it's so important to reframe it and think about the fact that, you know, this legacy of colonialism is an ongoing thing. All of this stuff that happened to us, these violent systems of oppression, and it happened in the past, but it continues to happen today. There's the legacy, but there's also ongoing colonial policies that impact Indigenous people on a daily basis. And it's important to recognize that settlers in North America are very much implicated in that story. It's a collective history. It's one that we all share. And I think that's the only way we can move forward, is to recognize that we are in this together, and that what has happened to Indigenous people and continues to happen to Indigenous people has been largely to the benefit in many ways for the settler population. I think it's really important to think about it that way. But also, you know, as an Indigenous person, I draw so much strength from my community and from all of the beautiful work that's happening within the community. And so thinking about, you know, all of that heavy stuff, it's also so important to focus on strength and resilience, and to step away from this idea of us consistently being at a deficit, and recognize that we've overcome so much, and that the only way forward is through leaning into the strength of our ancestors and what we've been through.
Again, wonderfully said. Such wisdom for a 30-something. My gosh. I can't wait to see where you end up when you're in your 50s and things like that, like my age, you know. You're really impressive, and I mean that with the utmost respect. Thank you so much for sharing what you're sharing with us today on Troubadours and Rock On Tours. And I know you have some projects coming up. You want to talk about those?
Yeah, sure. So I'm in a show called Three Pines. It's going to be on Prime Video, Amazon Prime Video. I think they just released the official trailer yesterday, and it's going to be out in the world on December 2nd. They're releasing the first two episodes December 2nd.
That's exciting.
Yeah. It's based on the novels by Louise Penny. She's a Canadian author, but she has a huge global following. So it's kind of like, it's a mystery series. It's a little bit quirky. It's also dark, and I play a detective, which is quite fascinating and complicated for me as an Indigenous person, given the history of policing in this country and all of that. So there's that show. And then also I just directed three episodes of a new television series called Little Bird. It's about the 60s scoop, which happened here in Canada and also in the United States, following the closure of Indian residential schools. The Canadian state essentially started to forcefully remove Indigenous children from our families and communities and place them in non-Indigenous households. Mm. And it was very damaging and continues to be very damaging. Indigenous children in Canada are hugely overrepresented in the foster care system. In the province of Manitoba, for instance, there's over 90% of children who are in foster care are Indigenous. And so the show is a It's a drama series. It's a limited series. It's going to be on Crave here in Canada. I'm not sure where it's going to be released in the U.S., but it's a 6-part limited series about the 60s scoop, about a young Indigenous woman who was adopted, raised by a non-Indigenous family, and it's about her journey home and her journey to finding herself again. Wow. And uncovering the truth. So yeah, so there's those, and then there's an independent film called Stellar, directed by Anishinaabe filmmaker Darlene Nepenthe. It's like an Anishinaabe love story that takes place in a dive bar as the world is ending. It's a beautiful film that just premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival, and I played She in the film. And so those are kind of the three main projects that are kind of coming out into the world right now. And it's quite exciting to be, involved in such exciting shows.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. And folks, you should check them all out. If you want to connect with Elamaya, you could look her up on, Google, of course. And you pronounce or you spell her name Elamaija, and then tail feathers, one word, and you'll find all of the projects she just mentioned on her website. Any closing thoughts, Elamaya, for the listeners before we part ways?
Not really. I mean, this is a really thorough conversation. So, yeah, thanks for asking such engaging questions. And yeah, I hope everybody's doing all right out there.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a nice autumn and winter, and hopefully we have an opportunity to cross paths again.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care.
And now a piece written by Elizabeth Bradfield, titled Plastic, A Personal History, published in the September 2022 edition of The Sun magazine. How can I find a way to praise it? Do the early inventors and embracers churn with regret? I don't think my parents, born in the swing toward ubiquity, chew and chew and chew on plastic. But of course they do. Bits in water, food, flesh, air. And their parents? I remember Dad mocking his mother's drawer of saved rubber bands and his father-in-law's red, corroded jerry can, patched and patched, never replaced for new, for never rusting. Cash or plastic? Plastic, even for gum, we hate the $5 minimum. Bills paperless, automatic, almost unreal. My toys were plastic, castle and circus train and yo-yo. Did my lunches ever get wrapped in wax paper, or was it all saran, saran, saran? Sarah's mom was given in Girl Scouts a blue sheet of plastic to cut, sew, and trim with white piping into pouches for camping. Sarah has it still, brittle but useful. Merit badge for waterproofing, for everlasting. You, too, must have heard stories, now quaint as carriages, of first plastic, pre-plastic, eras of glass, waxed cloth and tin, of shared syringes. All our grocery bags growing up were paper, bottom hefted on forearm, top crunched into grab. We used them to line the kitchen garbage pail. Not that long ago, maybe a decade, I made purses for my sisters out of putty-colored, red-lettered plastic Safeway bags. I'd snag a stack each time I went, then fold and sew, quilt with bright thread, line with thrift store blouses. They were sturdy and beautiful, rainproof and light, clever, so clever. I regret them. And the plastic toothpicks, folders, shoes that seemed so cheap, so easy, so use again, and thus less wasteful then. What did we do before to-go lids? Things must have just spilled and spilled. Do you know what I mean? I mean, what pearl forms around a grain of plastic in an oyster? Is it as beautiful? Would you wear it? Would you buy it for your daughter so she in turn could pass it down and pass it down and pass it down? 500 years. Plastic pumpkin kicked across the parking lot of the town's Women's Resource Center. Weeds break through cracked asphalt and broken cement foundation. Brick and mortar crumbling outside. Inside, people are quietly writhing with the craven injustice of 500 years. Teeming stoned in opiate foam that only a few will see. As the stories get further twisted deep inside the soul and bone, and wearing colorful headdress, we continue to roam.
Hey, yo, hey, 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 baby, I'm with you. Hey, yo, hey, hey, baby, I'm with you. Hey, yo, hey, 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 yo, hey, hey, baby, I'm with you. Remember me,
remember me,
when the sun comes up in the morning sky, there I will be,
there I will be,
soaring with the eagle so high, feeling free. Remember me, down the road, hand in hand, you and me. Hey, hey, hey,
hey,
hey, hey, hey, hey,
hey,
hey,
hey,
hey, hey,
hey,
hey,
hey,
hey, hey, remember me,
remember me,
when the sun comes up in the morning sky, there I will be,
there I will be,
soaring with the eagle so high, feeling free. Remember me, down the road, hand in hand, you and me.
Hey,
hey, hey, hey, hey, hey, hey, hey, hey, hey,
hey,
hey,
hey,
hey,
hey,
hey,
hey,
hey, hey, hey,
hey,
hey, hey, hey,
hey,
hey, hey, hey,
hey, hey,
hey,
hey,
hey, hey, hey, hey, hey, hey, when the sun comes up in the morning sky, there I will be,
there I will be,
soaring with the eagle so high, feeling free. Remember me, down the road, hand in hand, you and me.
And there you have it, episode 496 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Elamaya Tailfeathers, Elizabeth Bradfield, The Sun Magazine, Thelonious Monk, Reuben and the Dark, featuring the Bullhorn Singers, the Blackfoot Confederacy, Joanne Shenandoah, Link Ray, Fawn Wood, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard too. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.